Session number 21649, rule 5.
Is a real five, and all the time the boat was being hit by fire?
Well, not all the time, no. It was fairly early on, and the hits were successive. For example, the first near miss occurred whilst I was standing on an ammunition locker with an army captain, looking over the forecastle, so we could look over the forecastle to the beach. The captain suddenly dropped away from me, and I turned around and said, "What are you doing down there?" He said, "Good God, didn't you feel that?" And I had felt something, but I was relatively inexperienced at this close combat stuff, and the hair on the back of my neck had gone up like that. He said, "That was a bloody shell." And it was really rather close. But then there was another... There were eight holes, if I remember correctly. Because some of my crew were really quite inexperienced. They didn't know how to plug holes in the ship side very well, a job which you did with the aid of canvas and wooden plugs, big wooden plugs, and you thumped the plug into the ship side with a canvas ahead of the plug so that there was a decent seal. Because of inexperience and lack of people, I said, "Look, You hang on to my legs and I'll thump them in. I know what I'm doing." And I duly did that and plugged all eight holes. No, we were not fired on all the time by those guns. But we had a little tussle with the heavy machine gun, but we came out the best in that little battle. No doubt about it. But it wasn't very comfortable being so close to the beach for about 4 days. We just sat there like a sitting duck. Though it could be argued, of course, that the other naval ships in the area, which had decent armament, looked after us fairly well, I imagine. I've been back last year only, for the first time, to the D-Day beaches. And I haven't been able to identify the exact spot from which that battery operated. They were certainly firing over open sights, I would think, by the level of the shots which hit us. There you are. We escaped all right, except for the holes in the metal. And the wound of the RAMC corporal.
Why do you think the chaplain was the first off the boat?
I don't know. I think he thought that he had a mission, and he had an example to set.
Why do you think the Irishman was the second?
Why do I think he was the second? Because he was a fighting soldier with some experience. No doubt about that at all. And he was determined to roar up that beach and deal with matters. And he did so successfully.
On foot?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. He absolutely roared up that beach. And he went up the top with his Tommy gun blazing. And the hands rapidly came up. I still smile when I think that the brigadier had the opinion that I was going to shoot the soldiers if they didn't move quickly.
But you had vehicles in the craft.
Oh yes, of all kinds. Tank, lorries, jeeps, you name them, we had them. Yeah. There was a reluctance, but it certainly was not due to cowardice. There's no question about that. It was a feeling of, you know, is this the right spot to be? For example, they were doubtful whether we'd put them ashore where it was shallow and where it was clear of enemy obstructions like mines and so forth. We'd no way of knowing that. There were craft alongside as if it just blew up because they hit the mines and we didn't. But in order to prove that we had got a reasonable depth of water just off the door, I got one of my able seamen to put a sounding pole in to measure the depth of water, and that was well within limits. And they still weren't too happy about it. And I can remember that I said, right, well, look, I'll show you. And I walked off the end of the door and started walking. I mean, the water came up to about here, I suppose. Look, that's it.
Your ankle.
Yeah, just about. And the next step I took them, I disappeared after my cap. Because there's a bloody great shell hole there, you see, or a mine hole or whatever. And I had to come back in and get dry.
Was it easy to release the door?
Sorry?
Was it easy to release the door of the landing craft?
Well, easy enough to release the door of it, yes.
What did you do?
Well, he just took off the shackle, as it were, if I remember rightly. And the door goes, boing. Getting him back up was a bit more difficult. You had to attach the handles and wind this huge door back up. It's quite a considerable weight. No, we had many fascinating jobs to do there, and it's very interesting the way in which we got a response from every merchant ship we approached there to ask them for food. And I'd always ask them to give me the bill, and we'd see if they were paid. Invariably, the answer was that there was no bill. That this is on us. They used to give us meat and goodness knows what.
Now, you were going back to Shoreham, I think, with a hole in you.
We were. I think it was Shoreham we went to. Yes.
What happened then?
I'm a little bit vague as to which way things turned out. I know we had to go into New Haven, and we got caught in a gale. I can't quite fix this, but I know we had to go into New Haven, and it looked as though every bloody ship in the world was going into New Haven to escape gales. And it isn't an easy entrance. When we went in there, they put us up onto a sort of platform so that we could be examined for damage. And while we were on there, this is quite interesting, while we were on there, I recall in the early hours of the morning, the chap who was on duty the time on the deck, he came tearing into our cabin to say that there was bloody metal coming down all over the place and we could hear it. And I'd already been awoken by we had a water carafe and two glasses above my bunk in a holder. And I can remember this glass shattering and the water coming down onto me. So there'd obviously been an explosion of some sort. And I can remember grabbing my duffel coats and my sea boots and my steel helmet and telling the other chappy to be careful what he was doing. and we stood there under as much cover as possible, and indeed there were huge pieces of metal descending all around us in and around New Haven Harbour. And there was a lot of activity in the sheds on the opposite side, on the eastern side of the harbour. And it wasn't until fairly recently that I was able to substantiate what I was told had happened at the time. A chap who lives in Gosport, whom I knew, and I happened to, we were talking about naval experiences one day, happened to mention this business to him. And what had happened, apparently, I had been told before, but nobody else was ever able to collaborate what I knew. There were two barges being towed past the cliffs at the entrance to New Haven Harbour when they were torn adrift from their tugs, the naval tugs. And in the gales, these barges, which carried high octane fuel, actually were run aground by the tide and the wind onto the rocks and stony beach immediately beneath the cliffs. And the effect of that was to create sparks which ignited the petrol, which blew up, and the explosion went vertically and then came down the other side of the cliff where we were. And I understand, I was never able to verify this, I understand that there wasn't a window left in New Haven, nor a slate on the or tile on the roof. I've never made inquiries there to find out whether this is so or not. But it was interesting that this man whom I met was able to confirm what I knew about these barges. He said, yes, he said, I was one of the crew of the first tug, which is quite remarkable, really. And yes, that was by the way thing that happened to us. When we eventually repaired, we were assigned to a flotilla again, but I don't think it was the one we started with. We had no great loyalties to flotillas because we were just sort of added to one as a replacement craft, I suppose, initially. But I remember we were added to another flotilla, but in large measure we operated alone on instructions from wherever, Southampton or Portsmouth, mainly from Southampton. And we were up and down Southampton water quite a lot, and more than one of our expeditions was across to Tréport, which is to the north of Dieppe. And we had to, we were taking American Air Force equipment out there. We were the first ship to actually go into Le Tréport after the Canadians captured it from the Germans. The entrance to the port is very difficult for a craft that only does 12 knots and is flat-bottomed. Because the tides rush across from that cliff face to that cliff face, or vice versa. The fishermen, local fishermen, their mooring is up the, as you enter the channel there, is on the starboard side. And I can recall that we got a very resounding cheer from these people when we actually entered their territory, as it were. We steamed up there, and when we got to the top, there should have been a gate across to keep water in the inner harbour. But the last thing the Germans did was to blow that gate, so that water never stayed in the harbour at low tide. Came in at high tide, it's fair enough, but there were about three streams which fed into the harbour, and you had to be very, very careful where you actually tied up, otherwise you slid and your rope severed. You slid into the middle of the harbour, into the stream beds. And we had several trips back over there. We became very friendly with the people in the local hotel, who were very keen to relearn their English for when they started getting tourists again. And we had an arrangement whereby one night we would all speak English, and the next night, that's to say customers and staff, and the next night it would be everybody speaking French. It was quite a good arrangement. But we probably only had two or three days there before we took whatever load it was back again. We were constantly being approached by particularly Americans to transport cars that they'd stolen in their travels, and boats for that matter, to transport them back to this country, but we declined. But the staff of the hotel were absolutely brilliant to us. They, when we arrived there on subsequent visits, they used to be waiting for us at the top end of the entrance, not far from the hotel, jumping up and down, shouting, "Ah, le bateau avec le cheminée rouge!" And we had a red band around the funnel, and they were ever so pleased to see us every time we came. And I think that if we had taken, if we'd filled our hold with coal, that we could have been mayor and corporation of that town for 100 years ahead. They were so pleased to see us. The RAF, by the way, they operated radar station up on the cliffs. And there's a monastery up there where they make... What the devil was it they made? One of the liqueurs. I'm damned if I can remember now. We did have some of that. It was rather nice. Yes, we did quite a few of the Tréport trips. We also made some history at Le Havre. We were one of the ships which went to Le Havre. And we all ran into very, very thick fog, which lasted for days. And that was almost as big an armada as there'd been on D-Day. There were ships of every size and shape and nationality off Le Havre, waiting to go in. But nobody could move because of this dense fog. When we eventually did move, I can recall distinctly that we sailed between the masts of a merchant ship which the Germans had sunk across the entrance inside the harbour. And it's the most eerie experience I've ever had in my life, actually sailing through between the masts of a dead vessel. Very strange experience. Yeah, one of the odd jobs that they decided we should do was to be fitted with paravanes and other and other equipment for dealing with mines to sweep the harbour at Cherbourg. Well, we were a bit shaken by this because not one of us on board had ever served in a minesweeper, didn't know a damn thing about minesweeping, and we wondered how effective we would be being flat-bottomed, being inexperienced, And we didn't know when they were going to capture the harbour so that we could actually get in and do the job. But we were duly fitted with the various bits and pieces until somebody then decided, right, no, we'll do it some other way. Which other way they did it, I never know. We also, we should have gone to the invasion of the Netherlands at Walcheren, which wasn't a very good operation. We should have gone on that, but I think that was at the time when they wanted us to be fitted with these, with this minesweeping equipment for Cherbourg. So we didn't go with the flotilla to Walcheren at all. And it wasn't so very long after that we did various convoys of groups of tank landing craft going across the channel. But, you know, that used to cause problems for other ships because with a shallow draft, we travel like crabs. Wasn't a question of there's your bow, there's your stern, and you're going straight across to France. Oh no, your bow pointed that way, and your stern pointed that way, and you went across crab fashion. So when you had two convoys, one going in one direction, the other going in the other, it looked something like that. Now, to any other type of ship seeing this, they would think that that lot were going that way and that lot were going that way, when in fact you were both on a parallel course. And we had a very nasty encounter with a convoy of Liberty ships. I had become aware of this difficulty, but the flotilla leader at the time didn't know what difficulties we presented to the merchant ships. And I can recall I was second in line. My skipper at the time did not know Morse or semaphore, and so he always had the signalman on watch with him. I could do both, and so I used to be on watch just with an ordinary seaman up there, because we only carried one signalman, and I had to transmit my own messages. And I can recall that I got a signal from him to proceed on a particular course, which he deemed would steer clear of this convoy of Liberty ships. And I remember I signaled back, no, suggest so-and-so course. He told me to do it, I was bloody told, but I didn't. I stopped engines, signaled to all the rest of the convoy to stop engines as well, and we laughed like a bloody drain when we saw him bring sparks off the first Liberty ship. He actually hit it, just under the bows. I did get an apology from him afterwards for ignoring my suggestion, but it was a problem. There were various funny things happened in that spell. The Germans were trying hard to do something about this difficulty they had encountered. And I can remember there was a bow fighter, which we, that was manoeuvring along the, it was flying along the south coast as we were coming out from the south coast to go across to France, and we were on our own, and on the surface to an aircraft, a tank landing craft looked horribly like a U-boat. The bow fighter closely resembled, I forget which of the German aircraft it was now, and I was almost ready to give, well, I was within a split second of giving orders to open fire on this aircraft. And I gathered afterwards, they were on the point of shooting us up as well, because they mistook us for a U-boat and we mistook her for a German aircraft.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the oddments that happened. Shortly after this, I had lost my captain, who wasn't very well sighted, and I got an excellent captain in his place, a much more experienced, who had been a policeman in the Isle of Man before he was called up into the Navy. And he was an excellent chap to have on board. He knew what he was doing, the crew liked him, and he's a marked contrast to Collins, who had been the second skipper. But I was eventually, and I can't remember the date, it was decided that I should leave and go on course for a landing craft gunnery medium, LCGM. And that involved all manner of courses all round the British Isles for things like astronavigation. A 6-week course, which the RAF took 6 months over, in which we learned nothing, because it was far too... At least I learned nothing, because it was too concentrated. I've still got the books.
You mean they tried to teach you too much?
Sorry?
They tried to teach you too much.
Oh, yes, in the time. Ridiculous. We had, in the period available to us, we had to also relearn naval gunnery, or brush up on naval gunnery at Excellent. We had to go to Lark Hill, to learn army gunnery control systems. I can't remember what else we had to learn now, but a hell of a lot of stuff. And we had the LCGMs, they carried a crew of both sailors and marines. The marines would be manning the guns which you carried, and the guns to be carried were either 25-pounder guns or 17-pounder anti-tank guns. And the idea of these, quite simply, during any invasion, was that before the army got their artillery ashore, they would need support. And the support would be provided by us from the LCGMs, either lying offshore or beached. And we'd have to operate their spotting arrangements and their firing techniques. But the idea was to use these out in the Far East against Japan. Bear in mind that the freeboard, that's to say the distance from the water to the deck, was, if I remember rightly, about 18 inches at one end and 2'6" at the other end. No more than that. So you were a floating platform. And bear in mind also that we were not equipped with particularly good radio sets, and some of the distances to be travelled from your whatever base it was to the first island which you were attacking were really quite considerable. We didn't fancy our chances of survival, particularly because our secondary job, after providing initial artillery support, was then to come off and provide anti-Japanese cover round the whole of the invasion area. But we'd then to form a screen, if you like, at the back of the invasion area, because the Japanese were using a technique of sailing their landing craft in amongst ours. The idea being that we would prevent that from happening. So there was two very good chances we had of being killed. But long before that, these damn things had to be got out to Japan, or to Australia, where we'd be initially.